The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, and on this episode, we'll be listening to Mental Illness Myths, a panel recorded live at Convergence 2014 in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hello and welcome to Mental Illness Myths. I am Desiree Schell. I'm the host of the Canadian radio Science for the People, and I will act as your moderator today. So how we're going to start this out is I am going to give an all-encompassing trigger warning because I am fairly sure we are going to get into sensitive and personal issues. So if everyone could respect that, that would be lovely. So our panelists today are Megan Press, down at the end. She's a psychiatrist in a hospital, unnamed, in Minneapolis. She subspecializes in psychosomatic medicine, which is the psychiatric care of people in non-psychiatric settings, and she's very interested in the relationship between psychiatric and other medical symptoms. And we have Olivia James. She's a skeptic and a teen skeptic writer who says she writes way, way too much about eating disorders, anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder. And to my right is Julia Burke, who is a skeptic writer and freelance writer-journalist with an interest in mental health. She's written about her own struggles with anxiety and depression, ADHD, and eating disorders, as well as dealing with depression and related illnesses from the perspective of a partner. And Miri, who I did not ask to pronounce her last name.
It's Mogilevsky.
Okay. Is a graduate student in social work at Columbia University. Her blog, Brute Reason, covers topics such as social justice, psychology, mental health, and whatever else keeps her up in the morning until 3 a.m. So I'd like to start this by setting the stage and talking a bit about some stats. What is the percentage of the population that is currently dealing with mental health issues?
So it varies because it depends on how we calculate statistics. Yay. The number I usually see is that 25% of American adults will experience mental illness at one point in their lifetime.
So what kinds of mental health issues are we talking about specifically?
So this encompasses all the diagnoses in the DSM, which is the manual used to diagnose mental illnesses. It can be major depression, generalized anxiety, eating disorders, schizophrenia. I'm not actually sure, though, if that includes substance use issues, which are in the DSM but are sometimes dealt with a little bit separately.
And I understand that the rates of mental illnesses are increasing. So first of all, what is that based on? How do we know that?
Well, we were not entirely sure because most of the studies that have concluded that rates of mental illness are increasing are using proxy measures like disability applications or people on disability. Well, the rules for disability have changed a lot in the last few years, the last few decades. And so there are a lot of other explanations for why more people would be getting disability benefits for mental illness. Another proxy measure that is cited often is the number of prescriptions for antidepressant medications, and that's used to extrapolate out how many people have depression. But as many of you know, antidepressants are used for a lot of things other than depression. So whether or not mental illness rates are truly increasing is not entirely clear.
And it's hard, too, to control for the lowering of stigma about mental illness and being open about seeking treatment, which, of course, we'll talk about more.
Yeah, it's easy to assume that an increasing rate is necessarily a negative thing, but it can also be a very positive thing if it means that more people who previously were undiagnosed are now getting diagnosis and therefore treatment.
So that brings me, of course, to ask, so how are mental health issues diagnosed?
In a wide variety of ways, depending on the mental illness.
Can we be more specific?
Well, from personal experience, a lot of the diagnoses that I've gotten are often you go in, you have an interview with someone, you take a lot of little tests about your symptoms, And they put that together. So there's a sort of a subjective piece and then a slightly more objective piece with the numbers and the quizzes and those sorts of things. And then they look in the DSM, and depending on the diagnosis, you may have to have a number of symptoms or only one symptom, and you look at the DSM and what the criteria are for a particular disorder, and you may or may not get it right on the first shot. A lot of people go through a number of different diagnoses as different therapists meet with them and learn about them and hear different parts of their life. And then hopefully you get the right one.
So a scrupulous clinician might also order medical tests of various sorts, because a lot of symptoms of various mental illnesses can actually be caused by just problems in the body, a lack of vitamin D or thyroid function issues, and a physical can help rule out some of these things. And sometimes it's a lot easier to treat the problem than we might think it is.
It can also be really difficult when certain illnesses occur in correlation, or there's a commonality between two different things. It can be hard to distinguish. For example, ADHD and anxiety are very commonly occurring together. It can be tough to tell which one to treat, which, like, if you treat the ADHD, will the anxiety symptoms go away or get worse? So over time, I know many people, including people in my family and myself, whose diagnoses have changed or who have realized that they actually have two things that need to be treated simultaneously.
There's also a lot of politics at play. Some therapists, probably unwisely, will not give out certain diagnoses because they feel that they're bad. Borderline has a lot of stigma against it, and so some therapists won't give out that diagnosis, which is kind of unfortunate. But a lot of that also comes up in how the DSM gets put together in the new editions of it. So, for example, in the most recent one, there were some updates to the eating disorder criteria to account for the fact that weight was one of the criteria, and they've adjusted that slightly because with more information about eating disorders, we've learned that weight doesn't actually determine how serious the eating disorder is.
But you're absolutely right. There are therapists and psychiatrists who are reluctant at times to give their patients certain diagnoses, and I think borderline personality disorder is a great example, because they fear that other physicians will treat their patient unfairly.
Which is really unfortunate, because we do have evidence-based treatment for borderline. We know how to treat it.
Okay, well, as the name of this panel is Mental Illness Myths, we're going to tackle some of those. So let's break down some of the myths. Talking about mental illness diagnosis specifically. So let's go through these ideas. Mental illnesses aren't real illnesses.
Who wants to go first?
Well, I just think about being happy and then I feel better, guys.
Yeah, and if you have diabetes, you can actually just start, you know, thinking more positively and it'll go away. And mental illnesses are the same way, right?
Just meditate away that thyroid condition.
So why is that idea false?
Because it's just wrong. I mean, we have facts to back up the fact that there are brain scans of people with mental illness versus not that are totally different. We have drugs that actually work on people, so clearly there's something physiological happening. We have people who will try everything on the planet to fix themselves and still can't get better.
Behavior and mood are products of our brains. And I'll sometimes have patients who will say to me, oh, my doctor says this is all in my head. I say, well, where the hell else would it be?
One of the most powerful ways to show people who are mental health or mental illness denialists that it actually is a real thing is watching somebody get treatment that works. And of course, that can be a little bit of a process. There's trial and error for what treatment works best, but just as an example, I really didn't know that I knew that I had anxiety most of my life. I didn't realize how big of a factor depression was until a psychiatrist was like, do you want to work on your depression? Should we be treating your depression now? Like, is that something you're ready for? And I was just like, my what? Then I went on antidepressants, and the number of people in my life who have told me, oh my gosh, you are so, like, you seem so much calmer and, like, more positive, and, you know, the differences that they can see in me, even people who, like my sister, for example, who might have, you know, thought it had been one of those all-in-your-head types of people, you know, can really see, oh, this is a real thing because you're different now and it's better and it's helping you.
I think, like many disagreements, this one has to do with definitions and how people define certain concepts. So when someone says to me that mental illness is not a real illness, I ask them what a real illness would be. And of course, they always say cancer. or whatever. And then, you know, and I'm like, why? And they're like, well, because when you have cancer, there are things happening in your body that we can observe. And I'm like, but that's the same thing with mental illness, though. And we have all these scans and we've done all these tests and we've shown all these things. And, you know, eventually they'll keep like qualifying and qualifying and qualifying this definition until it's become so specific that many recognized medical ailments no longer fit it. And then hopefully they see that they're just trying to exclude mental illness because it makes them uncomfortable. And it's because it's easier to think that it's something you can just think your way out of than to admit that, like, yes, we need to be helping people.
Okay, a subsection of this myth is the idea that ADHD is not a real mental illness.
So I can take that one. I grew up being, you know, the sort of the classic ADD kid with getting in trouble for both speaking out and not paying attention, for both incredibly impulsive behavior that I couldn't control, and being the kid who's sitting there daydreaming and in space while everybody else is, you know, looking at something really exciting that's going on. It's an inability to pay appropriate attention, and that is exactly what I had. And growing up, my mom read everything about ADD and was very good about researching it, but I experienced a lot of people who would say, oh, that's not a real thing. And even I myself internalized a lot of that and, you know, decided, oh, no, I can beat this. You know, this isn't something that is real. You know, everybody has ADD. I heard these things over and over. And the reality is that almost all psychiatrists agree that ADD is a real thing, and there's actually evidence of non-neurotypical brain activity to bear that out. And when I treat my ADD, I feel better and I am more effective at what I do, which again, you know, you can see the effects of it being a real thing. But there's a lot of people who want to say, because ADD treatments are so attractive as recreational drugs, because stimulants are effective at treating ADD, and, you know, college campuses, you see Adderall and being used for recreational purposes as well as for study. I think because of that and because of some of the aggressive marketing of ADD drugs, ADHD drugs, I think it's easy for people to say, you know, oh, because this is aggressively marketed, it's not a real thing, or, oh, because people are using these treatments recreationally, it's not a real thing.
But Julie is absolutely right. We've settled this. There are multiple areas in the brain, the prefrontal cortex, the caudate, that have all been studied, areas that regulate attention and emotion regulation, that have all shown delayed maturation in ADHD, and changes in dopamine receptor density. And the treatment of choice, the stimulant treatment, and others have shown to significantly improve the deficits of people who have ADHD.
I think the idea that an ailment can't be real if you misuse the treatment is a little bit ridiculous. Like, anyone who misuses morphine, pain isn't real.
Okay, so what, for the record, what's the difference between anxiety and stress?
Oh, man. Well, stress is an experience that we all have when we are under pressure or when we're scared. It is a universal experience. It's not an illness. Anxiety, very similarly, is a level of worry that takes us out of what we're doing, that that distracts us, that uses a significant amount of brain power of our resources. And then an anxiety disorder, to take it to the next level, is a level of anxiety that interferes with your ability to do what you need to be doing, to live a life within your values.
So what's the difference then between depression and just being really sad?
Very similar answer. Being very sad is a universal experience. It's an emotion that we all have. Our lives would actually be less interesting and less rich without it. Whereas depression, much more than sadness, is there are lots of different symptoms of depression, but the one that is always strikes me profoundly is the inability to experience pleasure or to have interest in the things that you would normally want to do.
So I actually wrote a over 2,000 word blog post on this that I finished about an hour ago. So on this exact question, so there's that. And I would add to that to say that depression involves a number of what are called cognitive distortions that have been categorized, and what they tend to consist of, like, way disproportionate responses to, you know, certain negative events in your life or just to nothing in particular. So for instance, if you find yourself thinking, if I don't get an A on this exam, I am a failure. That is an example of what's called all or nothing thinking. You know, either you do it exactly right or it's nothing. You're a failure. There's also a lot of what's called fortune telling that goes on, which is people predicting the future negatively with, you know, no real information. Like a depressed person might say something like, you know, I'm never going to get a job in my whole life. Although to be fair, you know, in today's economic climate, you have to distinguish what's realistic from what's unrealistic. Or they might say, you know, I'm never going to meet a partner. I'm going to be single and alone my entire life. So that's fortune telling. You don't really know that. And it's normal when you're sad to feel pessimistic. You might think, oh, I don't know if I'm ever going to, you know, if this is ever going to happen for me. But to feel so utterly convinced that you're going to fail at everything and your entire life is going to be miserable, that's a symptom of depression. It's not just sadness. It also robs you of the ability to remember what happiness was like and of the ability to keep hoping that someday you'll feel better.
It's also kind of a reaction in some ways to life events as opposed to, life events, you can kind of like project your feelings about yourself back onto the life event, as opposed to like, you might be really sad because you lost a loved one or something really bad happened in your life. That a reaction to that by itself is normal human sadness. If, you know, you're depressed, then whether something good happens, you can kind of like downplay it and its significance. And if something really bad happens, it confirms your fortune telling about like the bad things that will happen to you. It can be really, you know, it's a completely different reaction to life activities and events.
So depression is not a mood. It's not something that happens temporarily and then just goes away. It's continual, and it's sort of a constant state of heightened negative mood that doesn't go up and down like normal human emotions might.
There is a subtype of depression that's referred to as atypical because it doesn't fit with, like, you know, the typical pattern of what we think depression is. And the symptoms are a little bit different. So for instance, rather than insomnia, you'll have oversleeping. Rather than weight loss, you'll have weight gain. And you experience a heightened mood reactivity, which means that you can, you know, get cheered up and happy in response to very good things happening, but your baseline is still very low, and anything negative that happens still has this huge, like, extremely detrimental effect on your mood. It also includes heightened rejection sensitivity. So, you know, people with atypical depression might be overly concerned about, you know, being rejected as partners or as friends, you know, beyond what's realistic or reasonable, you know, given their situation.
Okay, on to myths about what causes mental illness.
It was definitely your mom.
Totally your mom. We all knew that. That's a quick section. So, how about the idea that mental illness is due to a character flaw or weakness?
That's wrong.
I feel like all you need to disprove this myth is one cool person who has mental illness. And I know tons of people who are cool have mental illness. So there
Study
we go.
Done.
How about the idea that addiction is due to a lack of willpower?
That comes from people who have not personally dealt with addiction or have loved ones who did it, or they have and they're kind of in denial about it, in my opinion. I mean, addiction, it's just a misunderstanding of addiction. It's a misunderstanding of the idea that the possibility for that is in all of us and what drugs do to people. You know, it's I think it comes from this sort of like meritocracy idea we have in this culture of, you know, this kidding ourselves that, you know, certain things don't affect us. And I realize that's sort of general, but it's very sad.
So there is like an element, like this much of this, that's true in that you can, through your own willpower, seek out treatment and recover from something like an eating disorder or chemical dependency. And it's really important to remember that if you are dependent on chemicals, to remember that there is the possibility of recovery. And so having that autonomy as part of your self-conception is really beneficial. But using that to blame yourself or to blame other people is just not helpful.
Post-traumatic stress disorder only occurs in people who have been physically harmed in some way.
I also wrote a blog post about that one.
We have a blog post for everything.
So PTSD is a response to trauma, and trauma is not dependent on like what your body has physically suffered. Obviously, that can impact it, but really it's about, you know, a number of factors, like your own interpretation of what happened and how much support you had following that event. And obviously, anyone who's ever been bullied knows that words can affect us very, very strongly. And to continue claiming that they don't is just denialism. You know, we see like what parts of the brain light up when someone gets, you know, bullied or rejected or whatever. It does have like a physical sort of effect on you, even if it's not, you know, an attack or an assault.
So I only really ever see people talking about this in response to something like bullying or rape. But if someone witnessed their whole family murdered in front of them, but were not actually touched themselves, there's no one who would deny that that person could have PTSD. Like everyone is like, yes, that is trauma. So for some reason, that's acceptable when it's violent trauma. But when it's any other kind of trauma, we don't accept it. So I think there's a bit of a double standard there that has a lot to do with other factors about gender, and about socioeconomic status and race and so on and so forth. But I think if you just think about the other examples of mental trauma that happen, it's really easy to see places where we totally accept it.
And I think a lot of people who have experienced physical trauma, they feel somehow that the existence of PTSD among people who got it some other way somehow invalidates their own suffering. And I understand why they think that. You know, if it's like, I went through this horrible thing and you went through this thing that seems like not a big deal to me, and yet you're claiming to have the same mental illness as me. So I understand where that comes from. But, you know, there's not like a limited supply of care in the world. There's not like a limited number of diagnoses that we can hand out. And if all of these pesky, you know, bullying survivors take them all, then there's none left for the combat veterans. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and you see that myth a lot with depression, with many mental illnesses, the idea, oh, your life is so great. Why would you have depression? Why would you have suicidal thoughts? You know, you haven't had that much trauma in your life. If that was true, you know, we all know that things affect us differently, and there's no one, you know, standard of what's difficult in life. Everybody has times when there's a hard thing that's going on for them. I remember I recently had a hip injury, and I found out I couldn't do marathons anymore, and the doctor is trying to make me feel better, and I said, you know, at least I can walk. Like, some people can't do that, right? I should be lucky. I should be happy. And he said, well, just because this isn't the worst thing that anyone's ever experienced doesn't mean it's not your worst thing right now. And I thought that that was a very good way to think about any kind of, you know, mental illness or physical harm in our lives. You know, comparing it to what's worse out there isn't really helpful. There's always something worse, unless it's the zombie apocalypse.
And we're still trying to work out why is it that when you take a whole big group of people who are all exposed to the same trauma, why is it that some of these people develop PTSD and some don't? And what are the differences in their brains and in their experiences that make that difference?
You're listening to Science for the People, and this is Mental Illness Myths, recorded live on the Skeptic track at Convergence 2014 in lovely Minneapolis. And we'll be back after this.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Okay, here's a fun one. Fun is relative. People with eating disorders are white women who have been brainwashed by the beauty and fashion industry.
That's what it is?
That's what they say.
If I had just read fewer Vogue magazines, none of this would have happened.
So I feel like my best argument against this is that I had something, an eating disorder. I'd never been on a diet before it came in full-fledged. I never read magazines. I never even thought about restricting calories. And then, boom, basically overnight, I had a full-fledged eating disorder. That's not really what happens if you're being brainwashed into some sort of horrible cult of beauty ideals.
Yeah, and also it's important to remember that when we say things like, oh, it's only this certain group of people that gets this illness, well, there's a lot of assumptions there. It is much easier for white middle-class women to get psychiatric treatment. Eating disorder treatment is expensive a lot of times, and it can certainly be easier for people in certain positions of privilege to access treatment and also to overcome the stigma associated with getting help. It's a self-perpetuating cycle, right? If you know, if you have this, like, idea that only, you know, white teenage girls who are middle class have any disorders, then if you are a white teenage girl with any disorder, you might feel a little bit more comfortable about talking about it or getting help than if you're a woman of color or if you are, you know, a plus size. Actually, the blog Black Girl Dangerous has a fantastic post about being a person of color with an eating disorder and how much many extra layers of stigma there is there, because it's kind of an invisible group.
There's also a history of eating disorders that has gone on far previous to the diet industry. I mean, obviously we can't diagnose people just by reading their writings, but there is a lot of evidence for women in the Middle Ages starving themselves for religious reasons. There's a really interesting book about this called From Starving Saints to Fasting. Do you know this one? No.
No.
Okay. It's a history of self-starvation. Unfortunately, at the end of it, they just say it's not eating disorders because they didn't want to lose weight, which is a whole other issue. But it goes through all of the different ways that people would starve themselves, the reasons they would starve themselves starting in the Middle Ages. And there are tons of cases that are documented of people starving themselves until they die. And so I think it's obvious that, like, hurting yourself with food is not a new phenomenon.
It is true that culture influences how mental illnesses manifest themselves, but it's not like this, like, simple linear causal relationship. It's not like, oh, you read a bunch of magazines and then you reach a tippy point and you're like, okay, I'm gonna starve now. Media sets, like, a certain cultural norm of what do other people do and what is appropriate for me to do. But they don't create, like, the disorder that, you know, is already there. Like, eating disorders are actually more about control than they are about necessarily thinness or beauty. It's people who have this, like, extreme need to control every, you know, little bite of food that they eat. And sometimes that's because they want to be more attractive, you know, though, as they see it, and sometimes it's not.
Yeah, it actually was a huge, eating disorders correlate with anxiety just as ADHD does. And that's actually, for me, in my experience, it was a huge factor in anxiety manifestations, like ways to control things, obsessive behaviors, really just a way of filling up my brain with something that I felt in charge of, as opposed to really, you know, the thinness, the weight loss, those are all kind of like the symptoms of what's actually going on, which is a control issue.
There's also some evidence that people in other cultures who have eating disorders don't do it for weight loss. So for example, the study that I had read was that girls in Chinese families would have eating disorders as a way to assert their individuality because they felt as if they were being subsumed by their family. So it's not necessarily exactly control, but very much about creating an identity for yourself.
That's true. Yeah.
All right. Moving on to myths about treatment. Psychiatric medications change your personality.
If your personality is a jerk to you, that can be nice.
I mean, like, it's sort of the point.
Well, I mean, there's this idea that it's not natural, or that you're anything that is part of you, you know, in your brain as opposed to, like, a physical ailment. If you were to get cut and you went to put a Band-Aid on it and somebody said, that's part of you now, don't change that. That's beautiful. Like, you'd be like, screw you, I'm bleeding out here. But when it's a mental thing, there's this idea, oh, you know, that's your personality. Well, when your personality is really affecting your ability to enjoy life, your quality of life, your ability to do your job, work, it's really not fair to have that idea that it's somehow wrong to change your personality. Mental illnesses are, you know, it's like, I keep making a comparison to physical illness. You can't, like, strip away gifts and intelligence and, like, things that you love, you know, when you treat a mental illness. Those are all part of you. Treating the mental illness helps you live your best life.
There's a lot of people who think that if you take drugs, you turn into, like, clones of each other. Like, everyone turns into these Stepford Wives people. But that doesn't actually happen. I've never met someone who gets more boring and doesn't have a personality after they start on antidepressants or meds. So it's not like it's going to flatten us all out. It's just adjusting certain things that aren't working for us. And actually, we do that all the time. We adjust what's happening in our brain by changing our surroundings, by changing who we talk to, by fighting with our thought patterns. And this is just a way to do that a little bit faster. And so it's not okay, I guess.
I think, again, it's an issue of definitions. Like, what is personality? People get very attached to this idea of, like, your one true self that is who you truly are deep down inside. In fact, like, our personalities vary wildly depending on the situation. Like, you're probably different with your in-laws than you are, like, with your friends at the bar, or than you are at work, than you are when you're, you know, out alone doing your favorite hobby in the world. And that, I think, we think of as normal. And it's not necessarily that you're fake with your in-laws or that you're fake with your children. You have different facets of your personality that you choose to express when you want to, hopefully. And what's interesting is that when people are not mentally ill, there isn't this stigma of changing your personality. Like, if you read blogs like Lifehacker, it's all like, become less shy, become more extroverted, become more productive, love work.
I can't imagine anybody saying, perpetuating that myth who has ever taken a psychiatric medication. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying that they're lovely things all the time. They do have side effects, and that's why you work with somebody that can help you find what works for you, which may or may not be a medication. But who you are, fundamentally who you are, like Mary said, it changes.
I actually started killing people after I took antidepressants.
But it changes.
Was I not supposed to do that?
I'm not sure that was about the medication.
Let's move on. The goal of mental health treatment should be avoiding or eliminating medication.
Well, if you don't need a medication, you shouldn't take it.
But if you continue to need a medication, please continue to take it.
Sounds pretty.
I mean, like, it's just reasonable. Like other illnesses in this regard. Like, sometimes you get sick and you take, like, I don't know, antibiotics for a while and then you get better and then you stop. But then sometimes you have diabetes and or HIV and you take medication your whole life. And that's not viewed as a negative. That's not viewed as like, oh, you're using that as a crutch. Well, you know, like, our bodies aren't perfect and they were not designed to withstand all of the challenges that modern society has thrown at us. And sometimes you take medication as like a maintenance sort of thing for your whole life.
I don't think anybody enjoys having to take a medication for their whole life, whether it's for mental illness or for physical illness. It's not very fun to be dependent on a pill, to have to make sure you're taking it on time, blah, blah, blah. But being sick is not fun. It's something that you have to do in order to keep functioning. So regardless of whether it's pleasant or not, it's still important.
All right. How about the myths about the people who have a mental illness? People with a mental illness are violent.
I probably shouldn't have said that killing thing.
I don't know the statistics. One of you will have to help me out here, but actually people with mental illness are more likely to be the victims of violent crime than the perpetrators, and that's something that is not often talked about. And also, Hollywood doesn't do a very good job of clearing that up. You see a lot of villains and, you know, horror movies will really play on the mental illness thing and, you know, oh, this person went crazy and then they killed people and stuff. And, you know, the actual statistics really don't bear that out.
One thing to note is that mental illness is a really wide category. I mean, we don't usually go around having discussions about physical illness as a whole category and lumping everyone who's sick in every possible way together. But we do that with mental illness. So there are some mental illnesses that correlate with slightly higher violence. There are also some mental illnesses that mean you're never going to assert yourself in any way because you're too anxious about it or because you feel horrible about imposing on anybody. So it really, I think, is a big detriment to understanding the nuances of mental illness that we talk about it as one huge, giant category.
The vast majority of people who commit a violent crime do not have a mental illness.
Also, committing a crime is not a mental illness,
right?
Which some people seem to think it is.
Yeah, I think the media tends to retroactively put anyone who commits like a horrifically violent crime into the mentally ill category, with or without any evidence. Yeah, that's a really good point. So if you're a white man, then you're mentally ill. If you're not a white man, then it's like your horrible, terrible culture. You know, so that means that, you know, hearing about this all the time in the media and like the few cases where it was a mentally ill person, we presume that the mental illness is what caused the violence, when that might not necessarily even have anything to do with it.
people with mental illness don't have jobs.
How many of us are unemployed?
I got a job.
I got a job.
I got a job.
I'm in school.
Damn it, Mary! Science!
It's hard to work if you're not being treated for your mental illness. If you have crippling depression or you're suffering really bad anxiety, and it can affect your ability to do your job, so that's a reason to get treatment if you're suffering, just as a physical illness can harm you from, can keep you from doing your job.
Certainly people would have to take breaks from their jobs at times when their illness is exacerbated, but we know, from our research that people actually, all people, do better when they have a purpose, when they have a reason to get up in the morning, whether that's competitive employment or volunteer work or what have you. And so the vast majority of people I work with have some sort of place to go in the morning, and if they don't, we start working on that.
And most people with mental illness want to be working. I mean, when they can't, they oftentimes feel a lot worse about themselves and feel as if it's a personal failing rather than the fact that they have an illness that's getting in the way. So most people with mental illness, or at least the ones that I know, have continued working even when they potentially shouldn't have been.
It is, again, like any other chronic illness or disability in this regard. You know, sometimes you have one and it really doesn't affect your work that much. Sometimes you have it and you need certain accommodations. Sometimes you have it and you actually can't work for a period of time. And then, you know, hopefully you're able to get disability benefits, which are extended to people with mental illnesses for that reason.
There's a real bias here in the fact that when this myth is perpetuated by an attribution error, basically, because, well, that person has a job and they seem pretty functional, therefore they don't have a mental illness, so I am going to discount them from all of my data gathering.
It doesn't count as a mental illness if you can still work.
Right.
That's not serious.
Can we actually talk about how all of these myths affect somebody who is dealing with a mental illness?
Badly.
Badly.
Well, it makes it really hard to take yourself seriously. I think it creates a lot of competitiveness in the communities, in that you don't think you really have a mental illness unless you can't work, unless you're having violent thoughts, all of those sorts of things. And beyond that, it really makes you feel like you don't just get to do things like other people. You don't get to go to work. You don't get to go out and have fun, because there's something really, really weird and wrong with you.
Yeah, it's a catch-22, right? If your mental illness isn't like exposing itself in or showing itself in ways that are stereotypes, you know, violence, not being able to work, whatever, then it must not be that bad and you must not need treatment. And if it is, then, oh, you're a danger to society, or, you know, you're freaking somebody out or whatever. You can't really win with those two narratives.
It also makes people avoid seeking help a lot of the time, because if you haven't been diagnosed with anything, but you know that like something is wrong, you know you need help, but you can't admit it to yourself or to anyone else, because then you would get this label mentally ill. And mentally ill people are lazy, they're violent, they're useless, they're weird, they're not part of our normal society. Then you're not going to be like running off to the, you know, nearest psychiatrist's office to, you know, take a test and see if you can get any help.
I want to take this opportunity too to point out that personal relationships can really be affected, not just your relationships with people at work, but partnerships, marriages, things like that. If your partner has this misconception or stereotypes about mental illness that ultimately make them feel that your mental illness is reflecting on them negatively, or their inability to be good partners, or the relationship, or their love for you, or your love for them, that could be a serious problem. So if you're in mental health treatment, if you're looking to pursue treatment, it really is everything to have your partner, if you have one, on board with you. And, you know, even if, you know, sometimes having them accompany you to therapy once in a while can be helpful. Sometimes just them reading more about it, doing their research, because it can really be a problem if someone with mental illness has a partner who does not understand what's going on and ultimately thinks that it's them that who is to blame.
Relatedly, those types, if you have someone who's close to you who doesn't understand mental illness, it can be extremely invalidating. It can feel like they're saying you don't actually hurt, you're not actually struggling, just suck it up, mm-hmm. Which is probably the fastest way to make it worse.
Yes.
I've also been told that if I'm depressed, I must not really love my partner, because if I were really in love, then I would have nothing to be depressed about. And I had to choose between either accepting that I don't really love the person that I love, or accepting that my misery is just normal and this is just going to be my life forever. So I didn't like either of those options.
Well, on that note, what's the most spectacularly bad advice you've received about mental health? About your own personal mental health, and that's from family or mental health practitioners. I'm very interested to know.
I think my favorite one for eating disorders was just exercise, and then you won't feel bad about eating.
Oh, God.
That's problematic.
Yeah, I know. I was like, I just came from swimming 4 miles.
Mine was also an eating disorder one. It was a year after I recovered and got out of treatment, and I mentioned to somebody that I had been through this 2-year anorexia thing. And they said, but you look great now. So either, you know, that perpetuates the myth that you can tell that someone has an eating disorder by looking at them, number one. And number two, I need their validation to be better.
I personally like, you look so healthy. I don't really care what I look like.
That's a horrible thing to say.
In your mind, I don't want
to
think about what I look like. Tell me that I'm a nice person.
Mine was definitely a generic one, and it was just like, just focus on the positive. Be cheerful. If you pretend to be cheerful, then you will eventually become cheerful. And the thing with that is, so actually recently a study came out about self-affirmation, which is, you know, a practice that is sometimes recommended, you know, of thinking or saying to yourself, I am beautiful, I am good, you know, I'm a good person. And here's what they found. So people who have low self-esteem, that actually tends to backfire. Whereas people who are doing pretty well already, it does help them a little bit sometimes. And same with they also did a study where they told people, they had like two groups of people, it was like high self-esteem and low self-esteem, and they had people tell them like, oh, everything is great, you don't really have any problems, just cheer up, it's gonna be great. And again, the people with low self-esteem were really negatively affected by that. So it's not just useless advice, it can actually backfire, because it makes me feel miserable, it makes you feel miserable because you're failing to help me and then you feel bad. It's just, don't do it, there's no reason.
The worst slap I had was not about my own personal mental health treatment, but about my choice to switch specialties early on in my training to psychiatry. And a beloved family member who I will protect their identity said, oh, what a shame to waste such a perfectly good medical education. She came around.
Okay, let's take some audience questions because I see some out there. Plug for the Mental Illness Happy Hour. I like the title. What myth would you add to the list?
People who make suicide threats are just looking for attention. Which is sort of true, because yes, people want attention, but how is that a bad thing? Everyone wants attention. If you're hurting so badly, screaming about it in order to get some help is a really appropriate thing to do.
Yeah, I think that myth presumes that there's something there's something fake about the suicidality or the suicide threat. So just looking for attention implies that they're faking being suicidal to get attention. That is almost never, ever true.
Most suicide thoughts are temporary. They peak and then they fall off. That's expected. But when people see that pattern, they think that it was never real. That thought and feeling was never true.
I would add to that a myth that I fell victim to when I had a partner with suicidal tendencies at one point. I took it personally and thought that it was something, I perceived it in some way, something that the partner was doing to me to hurt me, or doing to their family, loved one's friends. How can you do this to, you know, your family, friends, whatever? That was a narrative in my head for quite a while until I realized that not only is that completely untrue, that is spectacularly unhelpful to have that mindset, because it caused me to just take it personally instead of trying to get the person help.
I think that one can be applied to almost any mental illness,
yes.
Actually. I know a lot of support people who have had issues with that surrounding all sorts of issues.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's someone who's resisting treatment, how can you talk to them or convince them that it might actually be a good idea?
I think you need to understand their reasons. So, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, I don't need it. Oh, I'm fine. But when you really talk to them, you know, they'll say, I'm scared. Or what will you think of me if I'm diagnosed with a mental illness? Or I don't know how to afford this. And there are practical ways to, you know, get around that problem somewhat. And I think you can't help someone until you understand where they're coming from. And you also have to accept that, you know, we are adults, you know, who are autonomous. And unfortunately, you cannot make someone do something, even if it would be really good for them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, don't take it personally if they don't take your advice. You know, just be there for them and keep trying.
Yeah. Keep trying is very important. Sometimes people aren't receptive to something right away. Sometimes people have to hit bottom or close to it before they realize how much they need help. I've been effective with some people in, you know, just letting them know, hey, there is treatment available for this when you're ready, and I'd love to help you. And then eventually they come to a place of, well, I've got nothing to lose. I guess it couldn't get any worse than it is now, so I guess I'll try to get help. So that can, you know, just being there for somebody and making sure that they know that when they do need support, you're there.
If it's someone who you're very close with, you can also somewhat make it about yourself. So if you're talking to your partner, you can say, I really need you to do this. I can't function as your therapist. That is not the appropriate thing for me to do. And so I need you to have a therapist in order for this relationship to be functional. That's a totally appropriate thing to do, because if your partner has untreated mental illness, it can be extremely difficult to be with them.
The question was, to put in a nutshell, how do you help people find employment who are mentally ill and whose mental illness is, you know, sort of preventing them from being able to get and hold down a job?
Well, I mean, programs like the one you're mentioning are a really great first step, along with treatment, so that folks can manage their symptoms for as long as they need to feel like they're functioning at a level where they can do whatever job it is that is in front of them.
We haven't actually touched on therapy all that much in the panel, but cognitive behavioral therapy is really useful for setting behavioral goals and helping people get through like what is keeping them from doing things. And it's not just CBT, it's related stuff.
The question was about how to advise people to get help.
I mean, I would say encourage them to seek treatment and provide them with resources about free or low-cost treatment options in the area, which can be, you know, you'd know more about this than I would, obviously, but obviously like university training programs and things like that, or various pro bono organizations in the community. And you don't have to frame it as like, I think you have a mental illness, obviously. You could frame it as, you know, it sounds like you're having, you know, a hard time dealing with this. Maybe it would help you to talk to someone who can help you get past these barriers.
Yeah, it can be sometimes when you start with a diagnosis, like, you sound like you have OCD or something like that. That can be really, you know, aggressive. It's not
Don't diagnose people unless you're a certified therapist.
You know, sometimes framing it as a question, you know, do you feel like when you notice something, a behavior, or they complain about, you know, something, or they bring something up, or they just seem kind of, you know, when you observe a behavior or they say something about it, you know, do you feel like that's really inhibiting, you know, our work here to find you a job? You know, do you feel like that's really inhibiting your personal life? Do you, have you noticed this for a long time? How long has this been going on?
Let people come to their own conclusions.
Yes.
Yeah.
The question was about the stigma around personality disorders.
Okay.
Well, we can start with the personality disorders and the fact that they do seem to be, at least from a stigma level, carved out from the rest of mental illness, which is total crap. And the idea that that it's like just the calling them a personality disorder implies that there's a character flaw, when borderline personality disorder is a neurologic illness of emotion regulation and is very, very treatable.
I can speak some to the borderline question, because I do have borderline personality disorder traits, which isn't exactly what it sounds like. So there are 9 criteria for borderline personality disorder. In order to be dosed with full borderline, you have to have 5 out of those 9. If you have somewhere between 2 and 4, you have traits, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's less serious. Someone with all 9 of the traits could have them all at a low level, but someone with 4 of the traits could have them at an extremely high level. So that's just sort of the difference in terminology there. So there is really good treatment for borderline personality disorder, and I believe right now it's the only personality disorder that we've found that we can actually cure, that we can put it into remission, sort of. And so they're thinking about taking it out of the personality disorder category, because of course we need to keep that stigma well and alive. And that's through DBT, which is dialectical behavior therapy, which
should be taught in high school.
It's amazing. It's so cool. I'm really excited
can
about
DBT. Can someone explain that?
Seriously, you don't have to have borderline personality disorder to benefit from DBT skills. You can use them every day. They are awesome. And if we taught DBT skills to 16 and 17 year olds, we would have a lot less conflict in our world.
So I'm in the process of writing a series of blog posts on Teen Skeptic that are going to be going through each of the DBT skills and explaining what they are. Essentially, there are four different areas that people who have borderline have a lot of difficulty with. So interpersonal effectiveness, emotion regulation, distress tolerance, and then the final area is mindfulness. So that's about being present in the moment. And so the different skills are to help you be effective at those different things and incorporate your life goals into your treatment so that you can reach those life goals without your borderline getting in the way. It's really cool, and it's super effective, and it's evidence-based, and it's awesome. So how do you respond to people who suggest that you just out your own mental illness as a way to deal with it?
It's tough, and it reminds me of the situation in the LGBT rights movement of, you know, come out because it will remove the stigma of coming out and of being LGBT. Yeah, that's true. You know, the more people that if you talk about mental illness, the more people talking about it, the more people being open about their own mental illnesses. I know I became more emboldened to talk about my issues once I knew friends online who were talking about theirs. And I was reading blog posts where people were talking about this stuff. Yes, the more talking about it, the better. Should people who are suffering have the burden of taking those first steps and being being activists and risking stigma? It's not fair. But as somebody who has a certain amount of privilege, you know, where I can share mental illness stuff without fear of retribution. In my own life, I do try to, you know, write more about it and talk more about it to try to do my part to help reduce that stigma, but it's a huge problem.
So if someone is like directly telling you that, there are a lot of, there's a blog called Captain Awkward that gives people advice on dealing with all sorts of situations. And she gives a number of great scripts for when people are telling you to do something or asking you something. You just say something like, I'm not comfortable with that and I don't want to talk about it anymore. And then if they keep going, you keep repeating it until they feel awkward.
Stay tuned for more after these messages.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
And that was Mental Illness Myths, recorded live this summer at Skepticon, the science and skepticism track at Convergence in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Check our website at scienceforthepeople.ca for all the associated links. Now, if, like us, you're a fan of science conferences and conventions, you might like to hear about another one that happens to be coming up next month. I'm here with Ray Burke, who you might know from the internet as Dr. Rubidium. Ray is an analytical chemist, science communicator, and writer at skeptic.com. And she's also involved in Seattle's Geek Girl Con. Welcome, Ray.
Welcome. Hello, everybody.
So some listeners may have heard you on the panel that we aired a few weeks ago, Getting Away with Murder.
Yes, when I'm not getting away or you know, helping other people get away with murder, I do. I work for Geek Girl Con, too.
So tell us a bit about Geek Girl Con for anyone who hasn't heard of it before.
So even though it has geek and girl in a title, it's actually open for everybody. But our focus is on the achievement of women in all kinds of geeky areas. So it's a genre con, right? So like Convergence, you're going to have all your sci-fi, your fantasy, your horror, all of those areas, comic books, movies, TV. But it's also got a hard science track like Convergence too. So you're going to have all kinds of programming on astronomy and physics and space science and chemistry and biology. And the part that I'm in charge of is the do-it-yourself science zone, which is a chance for people to come into a space and be able to do about a dozen experiments all on their own. Of course, they can get help and assistance by scientists and science educators. So we'll be on hand to help people do all kinds of experiments. Like this year, you can do invisible ink. You can build your own miniature hovercraft. It's going to be really cool.
So then who else is part of your crew there? Anyone we might know? Anyone who might have been on the show before, specifically?
Ooh, okay. So, I'm not sure who's all been on the show, but some people that will be joining us will be someone on Twitter, Noisy Astronomer. So maybe she's been on your show.
She has.
Yay! Then we'll also have Dr. M.R. Francis, and we'll also have Danielle Lee. I don't know if you've had her on the show yet.
She has been.
Awesome! So we'll have her too. And then we'll also have Stephen Grenade, who runs the science track at DragonCon. I don't know if you've had him on.
No, interesting.
So he's a lot of fun. This will be his second year, too. And then we're also going to have Marie. She's an old colleague of mine from Seattle Central Community College. We're also going to have Tori. She's a huge cosplayer and a chemist. She also works at Shoreline Community College in the Seattle area. Then we're going to have Kem Jobber, so he'll be back again. So we're going to have some returners and lots of new people. So we'll also have Adverbia. She goes by Adverbia on Twitter. She's a biology teacher. She'll be doing our DNA extraction in the zone. And then myself. And then we'll have those kind of be our full-time workers. We'll also have Lousy Canuck on. Okay, so Lousy Canuck on Twitter, Jason. He'll be doing a really fun activity in the zone. We'll be talking about statistics of dice rolls because gaming is also a huge part of Geek Girl Con. We have a lot of gamers, both tabletop gamers and video gamers, and a lot of tabletop gamers know all about dice rolls and statistics, or maybe they don't know and they want to learn a bit. So we're going to have that part in the zone too. So we're going to cover all the scientific disciplines in the zone, and people are going to be able to learn all kinds of cool stuff.
So then what kind of panels can we expect from you?
Oh, there's all, okay, so Geek Girl Con has got all kinds of panels. I'm looking at the list right now, and folks can go to geekgirlcon.com and take a look at all the information about the con, as well as panel programming. There's cons like, hey, why isn't Bilbo a girl? There's also whole, you know, panels on robotics. There's also panels on sex scenes from the female gaze. There's going to be on a panel on what's new in astronomy, 3D printing. I'm doing a panel on double others, so characters of colors that are also non-human. So there's a huge range. There's lots of cosplaying ones and geekature, and so there's just a big, big mix. If you are a geek of any persuasion, no matter what your genre is or fandom, there's probably something for you at Geek Girl Con.
Is there anything else that we should know that is awesome? Because that all sounds great.
So Geek Girl Con is also super affordable. It's a two-day conference in October. Kids, I believe, under the age of 5 are also free. There's lots of kids-friendly programming. And sometimes some of the genre cons maybe aren't quite kid and family-friendly. Geek Girl Con definitely is. And everything in the programming book is rated. So people will know, hey, is this going to be okay for teenagers or kids or whatnot? And the zone, the DIY Science Zone, is definitely kid-friendly. So if you're looking for something to do in the Seattle area next month that you can take everybody you know to, this will probably be a good fit for you.
Now, do you guys have a fundraiser going this year? Because I think I remember that from last year.
Yes, we do have a fundraiser going, and we have raised, so our goal was $6,000, and we've raised about $5,500. So we do have a fundraiser. If you want to go ahead and travel over to the Geek Girl Con website, you'll probably find our fundraiser on the front page or on the blog. And we're doing all kinds of wacky acts of whimsy to say thank you for all our donors. And I will tell your listeners, that maybe some of them will remember Macarena, if we hit our goal of $6,000, every single zone person is going to get together and lip sync and dance to My Karina. So either that will scare people into not donating or inspire them to donate. I'm not really sure which one.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
So where and when is this lovely event?
It is October 10th and 11th at the Washington State Convention Center, downtown Seattle. So a great location. And again, you can take a look at our website. We've also got some discounts on area hotels that are running right now. And of course, if you're in the Seattle area, I hope that you'll stop by. Passes will be available. Last year, though, I do want to tell people that they did sell out right before the con started. And you can purchase them online, so you might want to take a look a bit early.
Fantastic information, and I will definitely see you there. I am using that's going to be a vacation for me.
Yay! So,
wonderful. Ray, as always, great to talk to you.
Thank you.
And that's it for us. Head to our website at scienceforthepeople.ca for all our social media links. And, of course, there's also one to iTunes so that you can write us a glowing review, download past episodes, and subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.
Science for the People is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders. Ryan Bromsgrove is our promotions manager. Our social media manager is Chelsea Butler. K.O. Myers updates our website. Helen Quivillon is our publishing liaison. Ed Haynes is our guest coordinator. We get research help from Josh Witten. The show is edited by K.O. Myers and Ryan Bromsgrove. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders, Marie-Claire Shanahan, and me, Desiree Shell.